This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Viola Davis was already an accomplished stage actress when she appeared in the film Doubt in 2008. It was a breakthrough performance for her. She played the mother of a boy at a Catholic school. He's the school's only black student, and he might have been getting much too much attention from a priest. In one scene, she confronts the principal, a nun played by Meryl Streep. As the critic Roger Ebert put it, Davis goes face to face with the preeminent film actress of this generation, and it's a confrontation of two equals that generates terrifying power.
I believe this man is creating, or may have already brought about, an improper relationship with your son.
I don't know.
I know. I am right.
Why you gotta know something like that for sure when you don't?
What kind of mother are you?
Excuse me, but you don't know enough about life to say a thing like that, sister.
I know enough.
You know the rules, maybe, but that don't cover it.
I know what I won't accept.
You accept what you gotta accept and you work with it.
This man is in my school.
Well, he's gotta be somewhere. Maybe he's doing some good, too.
After the boys.
Well, maybe some of them boys want to get caught.
Davis has a kind of gravitas, an immense presence that's always marked her performances. And now she's playing Michelle Obama in the series The First Lady. It looks at the lives in the White House of Obama, Betty Ford, and Eleanor Roosevelt. This week, Viola Davis's memoir comes out, and it's called Finding Me. So I can't help but ask you this. You get a call from your agent and says, Viola, we've got an offer for you to play Michelle Obama. What runs through your mind when you hear that? Do you run for the hills?
I tried to run for the hills, but they ran into the hills and got me.
They found you.
They found me. But yeah, I mean, terrified. But, you know, at the same time, I saw it as an incredible challenge. And during that time, it was right after How to Get Away with Murder had ended and we were in the pandemic, and definitely was having a weird existential crisis. And, you know, whenever you have those kind of crises, I feel like you need to attack it boldly and radically. And so I saw that as a sign.
Now, I don't know anything about acting. I've never acted except in one disastrous school play. But about the Obamas, I do. I wrote a book about Barack Obama's rise to the presidency. And I've had the experience when talking with Michelle Obama that she will indicate that really, for all the public attention and focus on them, that one really has no idea about the pressures of being that kind of public figure, much less the president and the first lady. That presents to you a real challenge of knowability, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I really didn't have anything to go on except for artistic license and my imagination. But I think that's all anyone has to go on, which is why, you know, when you first start out acting, that's why they tell you to study life. As you move through your life, you take note and you take stock in every circumstance. What was I thinking when my dad died? Mm. Who came to the funeral? What does a funeral look like? And you use that, you put it in your lexicon of information. Then when you play any character, that becomes your research material. That's why they tell you to study life.
So when you're going to play a real person and a person that inhabits an enormous historical space, what do you fasten on to? Are there her mannerisms, her physicality, or something within you? What gave you some sense of something to hang on to with Michelle Obama?
You have to, first of all, you got to do all of it. That's just the way it is. If you don't do all of it and rely on the makeup artist, the hairstylist, all of those things, then people will say that you haven't transformed. But with Michelle Obama, for me, this is a big deal for me, is her worth. Her worth as a black woman, especially. that when she walks into a room, this is a woman that does not feel invisible. So how does she take up space? That's the first thing I drew on, because I'm not always that. I always say that if I weren't famous, I would be invisible to people, not to myself, but to people. Yes. And so I found that to be very interesting, that she grew up in the South Side of Chicago. She definitely came from a working class family, but she grew up with a mother and father who saw her and who saw her value. And then juxtapose that with being a Black woman, being the one person that sort of is always misunderstood, the least thought of, the least adored. And you marry those two things together, and I think you got a good start and you have a good foundation.
Now, do you want to hear her reaction to your portrayal?
I don't know if it's necessary. I mean, would I love to? Yeah, sure. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I mean, yes, no. I haven't really thought about it. Because here's the thing, the biggest critic in the room is myself. The validation never really comes. That imposter syndrome is just biting at your heels constantly. And you just...
It never goes away.
I don't think, and it's not just for actors, it's writers, it's for doctors, it's for anyone. You know, there's a level of not believing the hype, and you shouldn't, because it's like someone said about fame, it's like fattening a calf up for slaughter. You know, so that's why I say that about Michelle Obama's endorsement or not endorsement is, I think my endorsement or not endorsement is the most powerful.
Now, at the same time that this series is premiering, you've got a book out, a memoir called Finding Me. And in the book, you trace basically your entire love of acting back to one moment of inspiration, seeing Cicely Tyson in the 1974 movie, which I remember well, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. Mm-hmm. I want us to watch a scene from that movie first.
Okay.
I don't want to leave, Mama. I don't want us to separate.
I know. But it has to be. I knew the day would come. You know, I never did tell you. But the first time you ever read to us, I knew that you was the one. I won't hold you back, Miss. I won't hold you back.
Mama.
Make me proud. Make me proud.
Tell me about that performance and what it meant to you when you were a kid.
Oh, man, it was everything. I saw excellence and craft, and I saw transformation. I saw everything that is the magic of what we do. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, what it planted in me is that seed of literally, I am not defined by the boundaries of my life. That's what her performance did for me.
Now, you write so vividly about this in your book. You grew up in Central Falls, Rhode Island, in extremely difficult circumstances economically. Your father struggled with alcohol and was abusive, and you faced pretty horrific racism at school and in the community. And it's amazing to me that this performance, this film, somehow lifts you out of what seems like desperate circumstances and does something for you in a very, very assertive and positive way.
Yes. I think that people just assume that there's always someone in your face saying, you can do it. You could be whoever you want to be, and I'm going to guide you. I'm going to blaze a trail for you because I love you. I see you. And that's not the case. It's just not. I mean, you have whole populations of people out there who were never told that they could be anybody, who have never been encouraged. And for me, that performance was like, metaphorically speaking, was an encouragement. Someone planting a seed in me, telling me that, giving me permission to open up a whole different world for myself. That's why it's very important to see someone who is a physical manifestation of your dream that looks like you, because otherwise there's no one throwing you a rope.
In the memoir, you write this: when I was acting, and this is your early acting, I felt everything. Every last receptor in my body was alive, 100% alive, and I was not hiding anything. Now, Viola, it sounds to me like it made you feel alive in a way that you clearly didn't before.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, you know, I got into acting. I remember the big saying back in the day was, theater heals the mind. And it does. It's a sacred place. It's a sacred circle where you can share whatever is within you. You share your trauma, you share your past, you share anything that's going to make that character and that play and that narrative work. So therefore, you do what people aren't allowed to do in life. We're never allowed to connect like that. Not in a real, just brutal and joyful and transparent way. What kind of arenas do we have to be able to do that?
Now, you make your way to Juilliard here in New York, and that's, at that time especially, a very white institution. Tell me what it was like to be you landing at Juilliard back when. I forget what year it was in.
That was 89 to 93. I was group 22. Mm. Well, it felt restrictive. It felt like who I was, I had to hide it, bury it, kill it, put it in a coffin, and just mourn its loss and sort of be recreated into what I say in the book, a perfect white actor.
What were you burying?
Me. My voice. My hair. It's like, pretend you're not seeing what you're seeing. Let me try to change my voice. I don't know how to change anything else, but put the wig on, put any kind of makeup on so you can not see that I'm actually Black Girl Viola from Rhode Island.
You had a moment when you're at Juilliard when you decide to take a trip to Gambia.
Yes.
To West Africa.
Yeah.
Tell me about that trip and what did it give you that you weren't getting at Juilliard?
What I got was that whatever is in me is the canvas for my art. That's what I got. That art in Africa is not separate from life. Everybody was an artist. Art was a way for them to express, connect themselves with the world. I didn't know that. I thought art was something very academic, outside of yourself. And in order to create it, you had to forget you. Until I ran into the Kenyala and all the rituals that I witnessed.
Now, one of the most moving moments in the book is about the opening of August Wilson's play, Seven Guitars. This is on Broadway. And you eventually won your first Tony nomination for that. And you describe looking out over the crowd during the curtain call, and you see your mother and father. Tell me about what that meant to you to see them in that audience at that show.
That was probably the first time that it meant everything to me, because my dad especially looked like he was going to fly. He really did. And he was just definitely weeping. For a man who, you know, had a second grade education and didn't learn how to read and write until he was 15, I think that what he was witnessing in me was an extension of his dreams, unfulfilled dreams. You know what? I remember this is back in the day when I really used to read comments online. I really stopped, which is a good thing.
That's a mistake. That was a good thing that you stopped.
Yeah, exactly. But I remember reading, there was someone who was writing from Central Falls, and they said that my mom knows Viola's father, and he would come to work every single day, and all he would talk about is, my daughter wants to be an actress. My daughter, you know, my daughter wants to be an actress. And he was saying that when I was in high school. And I just felt, isn't that awesome that he was excited that his daughter wanted to be an actress? And there was no fame attached to it. There was just a knowledge that I gave birth to a young girl who wants to be somebody. And man, oh man, am I proud of that. And I'm going to shout it to the skies.
You talked earlier about imposter syndrome. Okay. Yeah. But you've now got an Oscar, a Tony, an Emmy. And in some cases, you've had truly historic performances. You were the first Black woman to win an Emmy for leading actress in a drama series. And does that change the way you think of yourself when you go home at night from the studio?
Well, you know, Brené Brown talks about this, that the most vulnerable emotion is gratefulness and joy. Because the next moment is like, when is it going to be taken away? When are they going to find me out? When are they going to... So it's being in the moment and being able to celebrate is very, very vulnerable. And the more success you have, the more frightening it is.
Do you ever want to pull away from it?
Oh, absolutely.
What would you do?
I don't know what I would do. I would most likely, number one, absolutely teach. But I think that here's the thing. It's the reality and the fantasy of anything. The highs of the winning the Oscar, the Emmy, the Tony Awards, the money, all of that is there. But then life also keeps going. And this is not to sound ungrateful. This is to sound very honest. This is not it. Getting to the height of your profession ain't it. Is it something to be celebrated? Is it something that I am very proud of myself for? Absolutely. But it is not a measure of success or meaning or purpose.
What is the measure?
It's significance. It's living a life that is tapped into something way bigger than you. What I live for is I really want people to feel less alone. Isolation and loneliness and lack of connection is literally a death knell. I try to do it with my work. I try to do it with my philanthropy. And I always target people that I know will be the most and feel the most alone.
What do you want? You said you might want to teach one day. What would you want to impart to young artists?
One of the things that I would tell young actors is you got to use you. See, I think that what happens so much as we move through the world, even with social media, no matter what, is we try to bogart other people's lives. It's sort of like going to plastic surgery and saying, I want Angelina Jolie's nose, and then maybe I want Scarlett Johansson's lips. You know, they do that, you know, with plastic surgery. But on a metaphoric level, I think that people do that. I think they pick and choose whose lives they want to emulate. And before they know it, they become a Mr. Potato Head of other people's dreams, hopes, looks, values, everything. And they never, ever focus on that inner voice within them, that mindfulness of just who you are. That's what I would impart with them. Because for me, I always want to see that one person walking across the screen that is going to be different from everybody else. And I think that that's how you do it. You use you, always.
Viola Davis, thank you so much.
Thank you. Even though my lights went off. Lights are on a timer, so yeah.
I'm sure you'll get it fixed. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Viola Davis's memoir, Finding Me, is out this week, and you can see her in The First Lady on Showtime. Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The software known as Pegasus is probably the most notorious spyware in the world. It allows users, law enforcement officials, or government authorities to hack into a target's smartphone, and that gains them access to photos, videos, and messages. Pegasus can also remotely control a phone's microphone and camera, all without your knowing it. The software is aimed at catching the worst of the worst, terrorists and other violent criminals. But once a surveillance tool is on the market, it can be very difficult to control. Ronan Farrow has a new piece out on The New Yorker about Pegasus and the company that makes it, an Israeli firm called NSO Group.
So one of the things that I think is distinctive about this story, against a backdrop of a lot of good reporting from a lot of good outlets about this kind of spyware, is, you know, I really got to spend time inside NSO Group and their offices in Tel Aviv, talking to their software engineers who take evident pride in cracking encryption methods and opening up people's phones. And, you know, in the conversations that I had with both the working level people at NSO and their executives, what comes out is, I think at times, a sincere belief that this is a tool with a lot of power to assist law enforcement. Critics, particularly in the human rights world, I think would say that that's a dog and pony show. But I do emerge from the reporting seeing evidence that there are law enforcement agencies around the world who perhaps otherwise would not have elaborate surveillance capabilities in-house. I'm talking about, for instance, smaller European countries, and who now have a tremendously powerful surveillance tool in their hands.
Now, do they have any banner headline crimes that this software has stopped? If they're advertising themselves, what do they announce to the world as their great successes?
So this is part of the problem. And one of the challenges of reporting on this kind of spyware, they say that confidentiality with their customers and the inherently confidential nature of law enforcement investigations prevents them from talking about specifics. Now, you know, people around this world have talked about various sort of European counterterrorism investigations where it's claimed that Pegasus or other commercial spyware tools were helpful. Very hard to verify because it isn't people willing to put that on the record.
Mm-hmm.
So this descends into the realm of sort of whispers and rumors very quickly.
Just to be clear, what about encrypted apps like Signal or WhatsApp? Are those things immune from this kind of spyware? Because it seems like not.
Not at all. Pegasus specifically focuses on commandeering wide control of your phone. It allows the phone to disgorge, you know, all of your texts, all of your photos, all of your calendar entries. It also affords the operator of the software the ability to turn on your microphone and turn on your camera and get real-time surveillance. So the protections of end-to-end encryption on a platform like WhatsApp or like Signal are meaningless if someone targets you with this kind of spyware.
So, Ronan, I've got my cell phone
right
here in front of me. It's a beautiful little device, and I've been to Russia, I've been to China, and many other places. Can I assume, as a journalist, that I've got spyware on my phone now?
Well, one of the things I did in the course of this reporting was to actually have my devices tested.
Right.
You know, I went in for some legs of this reporting in some parts of the world with only a burner phone, not my usual phone, right, because the risk of surveillance is so high, particularly when you're writing about surveillance issues in some of these places. And then I had all those devices tested. So you can see for yourself, if you would like, David. And those are proprietary testing tools developed by places like Amnesty International and Citizen Lab.
So countries have deployed the software not just against terrorists and criminals, as you've made plain, but also against journalists and human rights leaders. This was a very big story last summer. Pegasus was allegedly used to monitor phones belonging to people around the well-known Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi before his murder by Saudi-dispatched thugs in 2018. And in your reporting, you've narrowed in on a series of Pegasus attacks on people involved in the Catalan independence movement in Spain. So why was that used against those people?
And it's worth noting that on the Khashoggi murder, NSO Group is adamant that they had nothing to do with it. Their technology had nothing to do with it. There's been a lot of back and forth on whether it was in fact found on the phone of his wife. But it does seem like the preponderance of evidence suggests that this software was found on the devices of a number of Khashoggi's associates. And that is consistent with a pattern that we've seen around the world of this being found either on the devices of a person who comes in harm's way, who's run afoul of a regime using this software, or people around them. And that's exactly what we see on a massive scale in Catalonia. This is the largest forensically documented cluster of attacks and infections through Pegasus that has ever been revealed.
That we know of.
That we know of.
Yeah. So this presumably has to do with the independence movement, which the Spanish government views as a very serious threat. There was an independence referendum in Catalonia in 2017 that Madrid considered illegal. People were sent to jail, and eventually it all descended into violence. Who was targeted with Pegasus?
It appears that just about, I'm speaking figuratively, but just about, you know, everyone and their mother.
Of the main figures.
What was hacked, right, of the kind of central political movement. And in fact, part of the arc of the story is there is a Catalonian investigator who is analyzing phones and realizing how vast this campaign is. And by the end of the story, he's realized it's not just these politicians he's vetting. His own parents have been hacked again and again. There's a feeling of a lack of safety. I mean, there is...
Which is sometimes as much the point as the actual information that's being accrued.
Yes, that's a really important and good point. This is not just an information gathering tool for repressive regimes, or as we're learning increasingly in this piece, Western democracies using the technology. It's an intimidation tactic, and it works.
One of the people you talk to is Jordi Cuixart. Who is Jordi Cuixart, and why was he such a important source for you?
Jordi is a local businessman in Catalonia. His company makes packaging machinery, and it's distributed all over the world. And more importantly, he was the president of an organization called Òmnium Cultural.
Òmnium Cultural, it's one of the most important civil organizations in Europe. We have around 200,000 members. Mm.
And that group is about the cultural independence of Catalonia, and it backs the independence movement.
So, what we are doing is to defend the civil rights and also the human rights. So that means the right of Catalonia and the Catalan countries to decide their own future.
What's interesting about Catalonia is this isn't surveillance without stakes. A number of activists in this community, including Jordi, have gone to jail.
Was there a specific trigger that prompted your arrest? Obviously, it was your leadership in the community and so forth, but what was the actual catalyst?
Yeah, what the court said is that we, personally me, as a president of Òmnium Cultural, I had a lot of capacity and power to mobilize the society. And it was the reason why they decided to put me in jail.
Cuixart's lawyer and also his wife were targeted as well.
When I learned that my telephone was infected, I was visiting Jordi in the prison, living alone with one baby, but I was pregnant from the other baby.
His wife's name is Chel Bonnet.
It's like you never know what is going to happen with you and the information that they have about you, if it's gonna to be twist for create invented news or invented facts.
It's very difficult for us to defend ourselves if the prosecutor knows exactly which is our strategy of defense.
And do you think that was the objective, to spy on your legal strategy and...
Not only this, also to know exactly what we were preparing in order to protest against the decision to sentence us from these high years of prison. So,
it's been fascinating to spend time with people and communities who are in receipt of this level of widespread surveillance. One of the things that it creates, I think, is just an atmosphere of paranoia and mistrust.
For example, yesterday we went to dinner together, okay? Yesterday
yes.
night. But what we decided is to keep the mobile phones in the jackets and talk between us without the mobile phones.
Yeah,
why?
Far from us. The mobile phones far from us.
Because you feel that all the times there is a micro here who is listening. And if we want to discuss about personal issues or whatever, I want to feel sure that nobody is listening to me, no?
It's something that I think has a profound destructive effect on families, on people's personal lives, on all of these individuals I talk to who now have to wonder whether, you know, any personal photo is going to be weaponized against them, any text message, you know, if they've been discussing politically sensitive things, is that going to be the basis for an arrest warrant if you're in a place like Catalonia?
I think that this is one thing that, from my point of view, all the people who is infected or who was infected or who will be infected, it's important to not to keep calm down. If not, then appears the paranoia, and then you imagine that you have micros at home, somebody is following you, and be careful, step by step, because if not, then the emotional shock arrives, and then it's difficult to manage.
So, Ronan, were you able to confirm these hacks with NSO or the Spanish government?
So we have a former NSO employee saying that the company does indeed have an account in Spain. Citizen Lab, the watchdog group, has undertaken analysis that suggests that there is a Pegasus account being operated in Spain. And, you know, the Spanish government, for their part, won't answer questions about this. You know, certainly they didn't respond to our request for comment about it. Catalan politicians are convinced that Spanish law enforcement or intelligence entities are behind this campaign. And, you know, are in this story demanding transparency.
So what does NSO say about all this?
So I spent a lot of time with NSO Group's CEO, Shalev Julio, and, you know, he makes a number of arguments in defense of the company and the technology. He's also very cagey and careful when it comes to identifying customers. You know, he always gives the caveat of I am declining to identify any of the countries that we work with. But... that said, he did very clearly talk about some of the countries that we now know use his technology, including Spain. And in that case, he said, you know, Spain is a democracy. If they decide to use these tools...
That's on them.
That's on them.
I assume you talk with their general counsel.
We talked to their general counsel at length, Shmuel Sunray.
First of all, anyone who feels he's a target, I would really appeal for them to go and go through our process.
He says that, you know, if people suspect there's been abuse of the software, they should report it to NSO.
Because we are going to take this every complaint seriously, investigate it to its fullest, and to take the appropriate measures that are derivative from.
So the obvious response there that I imagine a lot of dissidents who've feel they've been subject to illegal repressive activity from a regime they're under, and they feel that your company is involved in a relationship with that regime, is going to be, those are the last people we would call. How can we trust that we'll be safe in that process? How can we trust that a company that is, of course, self-interested in business terms is going to have a thorough process of due diligence? What's your response to that?
But I think that our record has proved itself that we take these issues seriously, and we will continue to take them seriously. And well, all I can say that if it was our technology that was used, we feel very bad about it, and we'll make our utmost to make sure that no other targets will be in that situation.
Their central argument is that there is a, you know, a Geneva Convention for conventional forms of warfare. There are all sorts of treaties on conventional weaponry, and they are a weapons manufacturer, but in a space that doesn't yet have adequate regulation. They freely admit this, and they say, well, we're the lesser of evils. We're at least the guys, you know, letting an investigative reporter into the offices, answering questions, you know, trying to put on a show of legitimacy.
So you think they were trying to use you as a way to show what swell guys they are?
I think everyone is always trying to use us, David.
Fair enough.
Yes, look, I'm under no illusions, but I did think that it afforded us a new and closer look at this company and an opportunity to inspect their arguments, which are now playing out in court. They're being sued by a number of the biggest tech companies in the world, Facebook. And
so that's the pot calling the kettle black a little bit, no?
I mean, certainly Shalev Hulio, the CEO of NSO Group, cries hypocrisy on Facebook's case. But the Facebook dynamic is interesting because, you know, yes, Facebook has played this very destructive role in our society, but they also are the guardians of the security of a huge population of people who use their messaging platforms around the world. WhatsApp is, you know, a Facebook property.
Sure.
And that is the most popular messaging platform in the world. And all kinds of sensitive communication by dissidents, by journalists, happens on that platform.
So what has to happen in order for this to be reformed?
Well, right now, it's now a fight that is in the hands of coders, that is in the hands of the courts. And it's not enough, I think, in the domain of international and domestic law. And I think we're at the beginning of a period where that is starting to change. One of the things that we break for the first time in this story is that the White House is actively pursuing a U.S. government-wide ban on purchasing this kind of commercial spyware. And I think there's an increasing understanding that this is both technology that has an incredibly destructive footprint in the world in terms of the effect on these journalists and activists and dissidents, and also that it's technology we can't fully control.
It's like a monster. The mobile phone, it's like a monster. And unfortunately, we don't know exactly today who is using these softwares. Of course, the mobile phones help the humanity to move forward and to improve and to be a better society, for sure. But many times, probably, it's the most important criminal arm that we have in the pocket. So it's important to manage these two faces of the same device.
Right. Whatever the progress gained through them, what's the cost?
Mm-hmm.
They are monsters in our pockets.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely.
This is not technology that's going away, and we've just got to hope that some of these regulatory efforts can rein in the most destructive effects of it.
Ronan Farrow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can read Ronan Farrow's story, How Democracies Spy on Their Citizens, at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, we're going to close the show today with the cartoonist, Liana Fink. Liana is a regular and really beloved presence at the New Yorker, and she's written a number of books. Her new one is called Let There Be Light. It's a graphic retelling of the book of Genesis featuring a female god, whom Liana calls a self-portrait. A few years ago, we spent the day with Liana Fink as she worked on some drawings for the New Yorker.
Hello? Avenue K, next to one on track 8, stopping on Liberal, Rockwell, Santa, Baldwin, Freeport, Merrick, Belmore, Wantagh, Seaford, Massapequa, Massapequa.
She met our producer early in the morning at the terminal of the Long Island Railroad. That's the commuter train that runs east of New York City.
Should we get on?
Liana was going just for the ride.
I like to come up with New Yorker cartoons on the train. It's good because I don't have a fixed workspace, so I started working in fancy cafes, and those are wonderful, but they are obnoxious. Like, people are always eyeing your table because they want to sit at it. I can't stand when people talk to me when I'm working, but I love when they talk to each other. I don't like to be in a vacuum when I'm drawing. I think my ideal would really be to be a ghost and get to be around people all the time.
Go to 4, please.
I have a kind of sweet, non-threatening face, and I'm also like not a very young woman, so if someone felt like talking to a stranger, I would be the first stranger they would go to. And a train is better because people are mostly facing the same way. No one's going to look you in the eye.
There you go. Change in Babylon.
The train that we're on is one of the less fancy Long Island Railroad trains. When you take a different train to Long Island, you get a slightly fancier train with seats that go all the way up to the top of your head. But these seats, you can see people's hats. There's one person in every fifth seat of the train, I would say. It's after sunrise, but not very long after, and the sky is grayish and cloudy, and there's a 7-Eleven and an auto body shop and a lot of cars, and it's a type of bleak that I like. It's maybe suburban sprawl.
Freeport Station, America's Next, this is Freeport.
I'm always mean to start coming up with cartoons on the train, but sometimes I just send emails and look out the window. But I start to feel free in a certain way. I think one of the nice things about the train is that I can't really do like perfectly finished work on it. Like, I can't make a finished cartoon. I have to just come up with ideas. And I think, like, my favorite thing to do is just to think and to play. And on the train, I'm forced to just think and doodle.
Station is Lindenberg. Babylon is next.
We're transferring at Babylon. We just got onto a fancier train with higher head rests and two stories and a bathroom. I printed out an old batch of New Yorker cartoons that I liked a lot that didn't sell, even though I thought they were really good that time. And I'm going to look at them and see if I can make them clearer, and maybe this time they'll sell. So this one is a pine tree with an air freshener dangling from it that is shaped like a car. That's good. I don't need to fix that one up. This is a hall of statues. Oh, I guess they're busts on pillars. That says hall of life-size Pez dispensers. This one doesn't bring me joy anymore. I don't think it's funny anymore. I don't think it ever was. This one is interesting. I think this one brings me joy. It says pigeon nest, and it's a nest on a tree that's made of garbage. I love pigeons, and I think I need to th- think more about, like, maybe the reason this isn't a good cartoon yet is that it's on a tree. Maybe a pigeon nest isn't on a tree. Like, I'll think about that. Oh, here's a stupid one. It's a bird inside a gator's mouth, and the bird is saying, "Do you even floss?" I have really good dental hygiene. Birds are like the dentist's patron animal because they do clean the mouths of some kind of gator, ala or kraka. The gator does not look anatomically correct. I once saw an iguana that got loose from its container on a train, and it was just walking like really slowly down the train aisle, and then its owner didn't realize that it had escaped, and everyone's just kind of like, what's that? It was really big. It's getting really beautiful outside. There's a pond out the window with those things that look like wheat coming out of it. The houses are, they look like a fisherman might live in them. It looks like it's, the town has been this way for a long time. I love that it doesn't look brand new. It's funny, like, I don't think I'm telling you accurate stuff about what I think about on the train, because my drawing self, I think, is one self, and my talking self is another self, and I just, like, can't access the drawing self when I'm talking. My drawing self is smart and savvy and knows exactly what she's doing, and my talking self is kind of a human impersonator. Like, in my drawing, I feel like I can be anyone. Like, I can channel all kinds of personalities and thoughts, and I don't tell myself what to draw. It just comes out. When I'm in the city, I feel like my social self, which isn't exactly my real self, is just on high alert, and she's always expecting someone to talk to her. But on the train, you have no choices, and no one's gonna talk to you. And I get to just, like, put her on a shelf a bit more, and then ideas come out. The drawing self gets to be alive again. It's almost time for us to get off. I always wish that I had a lot longer, and that's a nice feeling.
Liana Fink, Riding the Long Island Railroad, back in 2017. Her books include Passing for Human and her new book, Let There Be Light, the real story of her creation. I'm David Remnick, and I've got to share a sad piece of news. Sad for me and the Radio Hour team, and sad for you if you've been listening to the show before. Since we launched, Stephen Valentino has been bringing his intelligence and his wit and his passion and his knowledge, even his craziness, to the program each and every week. Whether it was running around the Senate building during an impeachment hearing or interviewing national security officials about UFOs, or the time that Stephen brought Patricia Marks to a sensory deprivation tank and the microphone fell into a vat of salt solution. And there have been hundreds more adventures. Stephen, the New Yorker Radio Hour truly won't be the same without you. Thank you for everything, and the very best of luck to you. And thank you all for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.